Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
After years of fine print contracts and getting ripped off by overpriced wireless providers, if we've learned anything, Paul, is that there's always a catch. So when I heard that for a limited time, all Mint Mobile wireless plans are $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan, I thought, what's the catch?
Yeah, but after talking to them, it all made sense, right? Because there isn't one!
You got me!
Mint Mobile's secret sauce is that they sell wireless service online. Correct me if I'm wrong, Matt.
You are right, my friend.
And they cut out the cost of retail stores and pass those sweet savings directly to you and to all their users.
I'm living in a cell phone dead zone, but not anymore thanks to Mint Mobile. You can say bye-bye to your overpriced wireless plans, jaw-dropping monthly bills, and unexpected overages.
Because Mint Mobile is here to rescue you with a premium wireless plan starting at $15 a month.
All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network.
And you can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number, isn't that convenient, along with all your existing contacts.
Ditch those overpriced wirelesses with Mint Mobile's limited time deal and get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month.
Yeah, so to get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/rust. Hey, that's my last name, R-U-S-T.
That's mintmobile.com/rust. Hey, that's your last name, R-U-S-T.
So cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/rust. Hey, that's me.
New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. I just want to say as we close this ad out, there were no edits. We nailed this.
Nailed it.
It's like we were on a Mint Mobile phone call.
Beautiful.
I don't like blood and guts, but I love them when they're lengthily discussed. 'Cause nothing's more relaxing than the cries of death and lust. So spend a 10
ready to roll, Reno, and we are rolling, Reno.
Hey, Reno, you ready to roll?
Listen, I don't want to exclude you listeners, but if you were baby Xenomorph level subscribers and watching the live stream, you would know what that meant. Oh, that's a cold move on my part. And the best part is if you were a baby Xeno subscriber, you would know what that meant and still go, why am I paying for this shit?
Just so you don't bang your head up against the wall being like, is it a line from a movie or a TV show or a lyric that I should know? No, it's something from my dad's high school days.
So not Googleable.
Right. Yes. But what is Googleable anymore, Matt? I heard they've really been dropping the ball lately. Have you heard that?
Have they? Have they been eclipsed by ChatGPT?
Perhaps. I just hear that they don't. It's not as sharp as it used to. But Matt, we're not here to talk about Google's functions.
No.
You're Matt Gourley, and I'm Paul Rust.
That's right. And this is the aforementioned with Gourley and Rust, where we talk at length about films that are cozy and downright easy to be easy listening talked about.
Somebody said in the comments, they were like, in terms of cozy, The Shining is a cozy siren call that brings you to the rocky shores to your death. And it's true. I felt like that got at a description of what that job interview scene is for me. It is the cozy siren call. And then I'm halfway into the movie and I'm landing on spiky, pointy rocks.
It's a cozy siren call for conspiracies as well. Because if you just plant a seed, if someone finds their own seed, as we'll discuss with this movie, you go down a rabbit hole of confirmation bias and virus.
Ooh, hey, bias, it can be a virus.
You can find anything you want in this movie, as evidenced by these poor, unfortunate souls in this documentary. But let's talk a little business.
Yeah, business.
You can go to patreon.com/withgorleyandrust and get the live screaming and get mailbag episodes and get... They're watching us right now.
Hi, y'all.
Hi. They can see how disheveled I am. I'm working on 2 hours of sleep and just the words will come as they come. That's all I can say.
You don't look an hour under 8 hours of sleep.
Oh, no, I do. Look at this. My hair is moving in
It's good. Your bedhead is, sort of charming, like in a Jimmy Fallon 2001 way.
This looks like...
I mean Jimmy Fallon in the movie 2001 A Space.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, which there is a version of that.
Who's he playing? Hal? Or Dave?
Dave, this will be so awesome. Here, play this game with me. You rule. This rules. This is so awesome. You're awesome. I'm excited you're here. This is awesome, Dave.
Get ready to rap battle, Dave. Lip sync battle, Dave.
But you were saying 2 hours of sleep. You had a rough night with your child. And some people might think, oh, your child couldn't sleep. It was waking you up. No. She was doing roof construction.
That's right.
Keeping you up all night with hammering.
Absolutely. A job we didn't even ask for.
But a job that was needed.
Well, she's building a second story, but it's a kids' playhouse second story, so it doesn't make much sense. There's a full-size staircase going up to a tiny house.
I did say to Glenn, I was like, Glenn, great work. You chip off the old block, so to speak, with your carpenter dad. But I was like, be honest, Glenn, this is for you, right? I mean, you're building a thing that's a playhouse. That's not for your parents. And she looked at me like, hush, hush.
Yeah, you're cool. I'll let you know.
Yes.
That's Glenn, all right.
Yeah. Glenn, who I got to see. She was heading off to the zoo.
Yeah, with Shay Shay, our sister-in-law, my sister-in-law, who's so wonderful.
Yes.
So here's the thing. One of the perks you get, among many others of being a Patreon subscriber, is if you're at the Baby Freddy or Baby Zeno level, on the fourth Tuesday of every month, typically you get a feature-length commentary. Mm-hmm. We were going to do the double Halloween 6 this month, where we run producers and theatrical cut at the same time and do a commentary. We are yet again bumping that one more month. Don't worry, it won't get bumped again because... next month's October and that's Halloween. We're not going
to happen.
If we bumped it that month, you have every right to ask for a refund. But the reason we're bumping it is because this month it's time for the annual Cozy Awards.
Yeah. It's something that, it's snuck up on us.
That's right.
Like a cozy mist.
Or a fog.
Or a cozy fog.
A mist, a fog?
The velvet fog.
Oh, Mel Torme.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's weird that they call Mel Torme the velvet fog and not the Melvet fog, with his name being Mel.
You've proven time and time again that life's little sayings could use a Paul Rust punch-up. You know what I mean? Like, if there was a system that could funnel it through you, I'd say at least 50%, if not 9 out of 10 times, they'd come out better than they went.
Hey, well, no, you're the king of knowing expressions. I was like, we had to close the curtains here. And you said, it's curtains for you. And I was like, what is that from? Here I'm thinking it's an interior decorator thing. Like when the house is done getting decorated, it's curtains.
I like that. I like that.
Then I just didn't even say that aloud. Too dumb. Too stupid, I thought. And then you said, you were just like, oh, I think it might be a theater term, like when the curtains close at the end of a thing. It's
that's
it,
just a guess, though. I could be wrong. It could be something where they do pour, like, lay curtains over you. I mean, they put pennies on your eyes. That's some weird shit.
Yeah.
That's weirder than if they were to put curtains on you.
And if you're Lenin, they pickle you so you don't ever rot.
Oh, yeah.
That's weird. What are those chemicals? And could anybody do that?
That's a good question. Is it vinegar that you use for regular pickling?
I think it is. He's just a big tank of vinegar. And do you think those pickles that are like chopped like circles that you get on burgers?
Oh, yeah. With the little ridges, like a Ruffles?
Yeah, with the little ridges, circles.
Do you think Lennon is pickled in the sense that he's preserved and you could eat him? Like, because, you know, have you ever had pickled eggs? They're delicious.
Yes, that's funny. I thought also maybe he's pickled on vodka.
Vodka.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
But you were saying that there are crazy theories abound in terms of Room 237.
Yes.
What made me think of that was there's probably some crazy theory out there that somebody's like, you know, you could eat Lennon. Because he's pickled.
I bet, yeah. I bet, or that he's coming back. Like, it's a form of cryogenetic freezing or cryogenic freezing, but pickling. But you come back as the Vlasic Pickles, Groucho Marx dork.
Well, I was just thinking, like, could they do that with Disney in this hypothetical thing? And that is maybe, speaking of conspiracy theories, my favorite conspiracy theory is they named the Snow Princess movie Frozen, so it would mess up your Google searches for Frozen Disney. Walt Disney, Frozen Disney.
Whoa.
I doubt that's true.
They should have named it Cryogenically Frozen Head. Disney's Cryogenically Frozen Head.
Parentheses, until there is a cure for cancer.
: Subtitle, was not a Nazi.
Well, they're clearing it up. They're making sure everything's squared away.
Okay. If you subscribe at the Xenomorph level, you get to live scream. You also get your name read out on the podcast. Mm-hmm. If you email us at withgorleyandrust@gmail.com, we'll read some of those at the end.
That's right.
The only other bit of business is I got a little gift for you.
What?
Here. This is a Friday the 13th spooktacular mug and a print.
Can I open it?
Yeah, of course you can.
This is so cool.
These are for sale. You can just go to mattgorley.com. Check them out.
Oh, my God. It's glossy, man.
It's metallic even.
Whoa. You know what this is giving me good feelings about? Like when I would get something free at a cool event when I was a kid. And I got to take it home. Like, you'd get something like this at Disneyland or Universal, like the map or something. This is truly it would have this material. So where can people get this? MattGorley.com?
You can just go to MattGorley.com. There's also some Townland vinyl on sale for a limited time. You can get there.
Oh, that's good.
And, Paul, that's just a keepsake. I am not a fan of giving someone something that they feel like they have the responsibility to hang on their wall. So you just tuck that away and look at it whenever you need a little moment.
Hang on to a wall. I'm going to hang on to it for the rest of my life. I'm not going to, you know, let a wall be responsible for it. No, thank you so much.
That's you're welcome.
Very cool. What was your most prized poster when you were a kid?
Oh, well, I had the Revenge of the Jedi.
That's right. Poster,
the one sheet that was huge.
And tough to beat.
Yeah, I don't think I took the greatest care of it. I still have it. It's framed, but it's got little frayed edges and stuff. We bought two. One disappeared. We never knew where it went.
Oh, well, you know why I had frayed edges? Oh, I'm sorry, because I loved it.
Oh, yeah.
Because I wanted to have it as part of my life. I didn't want it rolled up into a tube.
I think I both thumbtacked and cellophane taped it up on my wall.
Yeah. I had a Superman 1978 poster.
Oh,
that was
really?
The clouds. That's just the rainbow beam with the Superman symbol inside it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That says, like, you'll believe a man can fly or whatever. And, that the corners were just so sad.
Yeah.
Pinned a little pins, like pockmarked pins and like rips from where the tape was.
There was one point in my room where I had an entire wall of my room covered with only Star Wars posters.
Very cool.
And this was opposite wall to where I had ripped my Cowboys and Indians wallpaper off and done a huge crayon platoon rendering.
Wait, you had a cowboy and Indians wallpaper
when I was young,
and then the part that got peeled off.
I peeled off a huge portion of that wall and did a big platoon mural out of like cheap crayon or like
awesome
something like artist's crayon.
Is it the wall, or was it the wallpaper underneath the? You pulled your wallpaper off. Now, was that just like wall you were drawing on or another layer
wall,
of wall?
And it was like rough hewn plaster. It wasn't even drywall.
But I bet it looked cool then when you kind of, it looked rough then. With
it did, because I also would put bullet holes in it.
What?
Well, like dig them out, look, so it looks like bullet holes.
I thought you were like, I'd go for target practice no. in my...
Tommy, don't put it past me. I was
50 by 50 foot.
Strange room. Kid. Yeah, yeah.
I worked at a movie theater... 98 to 2000. And so I got a lot of the cool movies of 1999 posters.
Ooh, so Phantom Menace and Meet Joe Black.
I got to pull
a two-sided one sheet.
It was nice because I was going to college, you know, so I got to roll up with those real true theater posters that are, you can see them on both sides.
Oh, yeah. The so, lit. Yeah.
So it's funny because, you know, Fight Clubs are now like a head shop. You go into a get a cheap Fight Club poster, but I had like a Fight Club poster in my dorm room.
You must have been king.
No. And I also had a Magnolia poster that I like worshipped. Okay, yeah. You saw a little corner of the frog in the frogs. There's a little bit of a corner. What in the corner? There's a little bit of frogs.
As in Magnolia. Hint, oh
in
yeah.
The Magnolia
oh,
poster.
Oh wow. I can't remember what poster. I know I had a poster up. I want to say I had like a Warner Brothers poster or something.
Oh, like the seal or
no, like the Looney Tunes. I was big in. This was when I had that hand painted Michigan J Frog denim jacket that people would ask me to sell them. The only time in life when that would have been something that wouldn't have gotten you beaten up, but people
would actually the opposite offer you money.
They
to
did,
have it.
And my Van Halen shoes. I painted shoes like
normally
Van Halen's
you would have
guitar.
To offer money to not get beaten up
yes,
by somebody
exactly.
for wearing that jacket.
Yes, yeah, yes. Yeah.
That's business.
Yes, that's business. All done.
So, Room 237, Matt. I don't know if you know this. The first time I saw this, I watched it twice within 24 hours.
Because why exactly?
I was so... Well, I was thinking about it. I would watch any analysis...
Yeah.
...essay, documentary, film about any movie.
Mm. Yeah.
Like,
I still will, too, yeah.
Like, somebody could say, I'm doing one on... Fletch Lives.
Oh,
and I'd be like,
that'd
oh,
be
definitely.
Close to the top of my list. Don't get me wrong.
And specifically, that it's not like a making of. It's yeah. just like six disembodied voices talking about like what they think Fletch Lives. Like, I would watch that about any movie. So the fact that it's about The Shining, which I love and obviously deserves some analysis. Like, so I remember I watched it on a plane on a trip to Florida to visit my sister because she just had her second child. So I was going to visit my nephew. And
the first time you watched it was on the plane?
Yeah.
Okay.
Download it for the flight because it was available to get online. Mm. And then when I landed, I was talking to my family about it. And they're like, oh, that sounds good. Let's watch that tonight. I was like, okay.
Yeah.
Sure, I'll watch it again.
I love that feeling when you tell someone and you liked it so much and they're just like, I want to see it now. And you're like, yeah.
I have it, so let's watch it.
Yeah.
And then classic thing, the next day, everybody's like, oh, it's okay.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, I loved it more the second time I watched it. And then the filmmaker, the person who directed it, made it, Rodney Asher.
This is his first film.
First
feature.
I know Rodney.
You do?
Yeah. Not like super personally or super close, but I really admire him. I got to make a video with him once with Josh Fadum, where we were like, it was Josh's idea where we were like two dogs, like humans dressed as dogs. Uh-huh. And it wasn't ever really addressed in the video whether we were men dressed as dogs or just dogs.
Anthropomorphic
like
dogs. Yeah. Yeah.
And the thing I most remember is me and Rodney and Josh all think it was really funny trying to recreate that thing that happens when you pick up a dog to like quote unquote dance with you, where on their hind legs and you're holding their paws, and eventually they do that thing where they just start using their mouth to kind of like nibble at your to let go. It's such a funny thing. Like, you're like, the dog's dancing, and meanwhile it's like, get me out of here. So that was a few years before Room 237 came out. I saw it, and then would have watched it regardless because of The Shining, but then knowing Rodney, and then, I talked about it probably for the next year with friends, and one person was like, you've watched this movie quite a bit. I got
Boy,
like,
Paul,
one of
you
reactions.
Really like Room 237.
Yeah. So the fact that we get to talk about it, I'm excited. I really like the movie, regardless of its content or the opinion stated in it.
Yeah,
I like whatever that SA film Los Angeles plays itself as this.
Yeah,
documentary or. You know, like Sans Soleil, like an essay movie where it's like a documentary that's voice and image. I love them so much.
Too. Yeah.
And I love the repurpose. Like, I wish more people would do this where whatever that opening shot was, where it's Eyes Wide Shut, but he's going to see The Shining, they replace the logo. Like, the just being a Shining fan and a fan of Stanley Kubrick, too, just getting to see somebody use the tools we have now to put whatever that shot from Lolita where they're in a process car next to the Shining thing that looks identical. I'm just like, well, that's really fascinating. Like whatever hypnotic zone I get in the movie too, I enjoy going there.
Yeah.
Like the same with the Shining. So, I hadn't watched it probably in about 5 years though. So
yeah,
it's nice to revisit.
Watched it since the first time I watched it. Real quick. I do want to say that, a movie like this, which is in itself an examination of films, which like you, I love, but the fact that this is a objective presentation of those examiners, it's not really about the film as much as it is about these people and their theories. Can you think of another movie that really does that? I can't.
That's funny that you're saying like, has a movie ever done that? Because there was a part where when the guy was talking about how is taking images and distilling a whole history into one image, like a dream, and then people can go and have this shared experience. And what he's, while they're doing that, is showing images from old, like black and white silent horror movies.
Yeah.
And the music that was for Room 237, the score that it had.
So good.
It was, I was having a scary moment watching that documentary.
Mm.
In that moment, I got scared, or it had an effect on me, like, ooh, seeing old black and white silent things, this guy talking about how people's brains work and dreams work and how The Shining, like, I had a shudder of like, ooh, this is freaking me out. And that was when I had the thought of like, oh, is there anything else like that? Like a documentary that can use images from other movies and have people talking about the movie where you would have a response like that. It was pretty cool.
Yeah, I have seen that kind of thing, but just the fact that I wonder if the subjects of this film, how aware they were that this movie was more about them than their theories. You know what I mean?
Saying, yeah.
It, like I said, it's not really a movie about The Shining. And I think the director has even said that as much himself,
because
there's so much out there on The Shining. It's about these, you know, pretty out there theories.
Mm-hmm.
Really quickly, I do want to say also that I would welcome a Fletch Live style sort of examination of this, because just to break down the, I'm Gantry, Elmer Fudd Gantry, to say like the combination of Warner Brothers cartoons with the classic character of Elmer Gantry. Clearly, if I had a dime for every time someone in this room 237 said, we know that Kubrick intended this. And half of those aren't even true, especially after reading this Toshin book.
I know. I mean, that was like the new experience rewatching this was the, like the amount of times somebody goes, I knew a friend in college. We would always laugh that like the more wrong this person was, the more adamant they were right.
Yeah.
And oh, so boy, you could almost clock it where you're like, oh, so-and-so's getting so... We joke about it. You're so adamant right now about this. You can only be wrong. Yeah. We know that this is the case. And we did, but if we look it up and it would be wrong. Totally wrong, as predicted. This thing is the same, where a guy who will have very specious reasoning, like those people are the ones who are most like, and it is quite obvious the typewriter represents Nazi Germany.
Oh, and the ski poster is a Minotaur. It isn't. It's a skier. Well, now there are varying degrees of lunacy in these conspiracy theories.
Totally. I mean, that's, I think, part of the...
But are we agreed that every single, what are there, five or six subjects in this has gone on to join QAnon? That's why I am eternally fascinated by the conspiracy mind and the desire to make sense out of things, but not follow the simplest answer, to follow a, like... really speak of a maze, going through a maze and finding the farthest and most complicated way to a solution because it's novel or because it's sexy or something.
Yeah.
And then just applying all that confirmation bias to it, going through getting a germ of an idea, then watching it to support that idea, as opposed to like really, I can't believe the five or six of these people aren't going, like, there's plenty to mine in this movie about the nuclear family, about toxic masculinity, narcissism.
Yeah.
And to get to the point, you know, I think you could make a case for there's at least like an awareness of the genocide of Native Americans in this film for sure. They talk about it.
Yeah.
Other than that, there's no moon landing confession here.
No.
There's no Minotaur.
Yeah, I mean, true that. And it's funny because I feel like, you know, the points in the documentary where you can tell they know, they're suggesting in a way that without, a documentarian's voice coming on and explaining it to you, it's the fun of, like, you get to, like, but, like, one of the guy's pieces ends with how you can clearly see in the cloud Stanley Kubrick's face. And it's like, oh, this movie knows that's what this is.
Yeah.
It's people looking at clouds and seeing what they want to see. And you can do that with any cloud at any time. Like,
but that great part about that, and that's what I love about the film, is they put that cloud up and there's no Stanley Kubrick there.
Yes. Or when the mom talking about the kid's drawing and be like, can you believe that what my kid drew?
Oh, yeah.
Like, something as simplistic as a child's drawing would be an artifact of like meaning is also like the inclusion of that in the documentary seems to be like, I mean, the thing I noticed was that like the people who are most reasonable will either come right before or after the least reasonable people. So that the movie does have like a tension of like, it either lures you in with a couple, there's two like reasonable people and they'll say something that you'll go, I mean, they add unreasonable parts into it. Like, I was holding my belt buckle. You're like, when he says that at the very beginning, you're like, oh, I already know you're a weirdo. You remembered what hand that's you were holding the belt buckle
that's
with.
That's right, yeah.
But then he says, like,
I had just fastened my bolo tie.
Yeah. But he's the Native American genocide guy, which, like, seems like the clearest explanation. And I read his... you know, on Shining websites, that newspaper article he's talking about that came out around Full Metal Jacket. I'm like, is the Shining about Native? Like, you'll hear something like that, or the guy who's like the editor of World War II footage. He's He sounds cool.
Yeah, that was a new one too, that all that World War II footage had been faked.
Well, he didn't. I see what he was going for, and it's weird. It sounds like fake moon landing thing, but I think what he was trying to say was when people were going to battle, when they took that image, they weren't really going to that battle at that moment. It would just be
that's
like,
very
we need footage of somebody going, like, let's set this up and get it right.
I see.
Yeah. But exactly the point of like, you get some reasonable, and then the literal or the joke of what a conspiracy theory is, they fake the moon landing. somehow like gets into this.
I know.
Like, because it's so,
that's the conspiracy theory. It's about like how people, conspiracy theories.
Yes.
Because so, it's fun because it's not, it's kind of a victimless crime. It's not like a tragedy. It's not like the conspiracy of denying the Holocaust.
You're
it's
right.
It's just
yes.
the moon, and you can. But the thing I
and
can't
the powers
get past
that be who would do that are fascinating, yeah. rather than just being like, yeah, whatever, something that's just like demoralizing.
The woman with the Minotaur and then the, her child drawing is, it just goes to show you how often ego is involved in believing in conspiracy. Mm-hmm. That you want, it's like, I think there's a tacit implication that you're special and intelligent because you can see things others can't, and you're going against the grain, and there's a pride in that, because normally that's like, you know, you're a rebel or you're a maverick. But it's amazing to me that, that the ego behind
yes.
believing that your child had some kind of synchronicity with this yeah. theory of yours,
yeah.
it just shows you that people will look for support for their beliefs before they'll look for the fact most of the time. And
yeah.
that's why we are where we are
yes,
today.
Yeah, yeah,
it's,
yeah.
it's like, it's both a laughing matter and not a laughing
yes.
matter, you know?
Well, that, interpreting, something to be about, what somebody's like own interest is, and then not having like the self-awareness to be like, oh, I might be yeah. projecting this into, like when you said they get to feel smart, like that guy mentioning Kubrick's, Stanley Kubrick's IQ, and then being like, so he knows, and the fact that I can understand this guy, it feels like sometimes the moviegoer's version of Mensa.
Yeah, yeah.
Of like, yeah. only a dork would really want to talk about how, I mean, there's times, a couple times when I was listening to this where I cringed, where I'm like, he's saying my nightmare version of how I sound and how I filter things to not sound it. Because he said something like, Kubrick was a master of depth of field. And I'll have you know, if people re-listen to all these episodes, I don't think I've ever referred to him as Kubrick. I would go like Stanley Kubrick, because
yeah,
I don't even like the...
I hope not either.
Well, no. I'm just saying, like, for me personally, I have like some... That's what it becomes, expert talk.
Yeah.
And I like to keep it at the level of just a fan talk.
I agree completely.
So that's the dance here. I like the people who are just like, have voices that are fans and kind of like, did you notice this stuff in room 237? But when they start to lead to their own personal theories that just so happen to line up with their own lives, it's a little interest.
Out of the gate, you don't need to dig far to know that there's an underlying... Native American tragedy under this movie. They talk about it being built on a burial ground.
Yes.
So it's there. But for him to reveal those Calumet baking powder cans as an elaborate but obscure clue that Kubrick had put in there for the viewer.
What I can't get past
is for him to see that and think that's a clue and not look, I don't know, two degrees of your eye's trajectory over to the bunch of boxes of Nilla wafers and not try, like, don't you have to give them equal time? Like you, a politician on a talk show, you know, like,
yes,
what's the Nilla wafers conspiracy?
Yes. And, also you could just move your eyes, you know, a little bit to the earlier scene where an entire room looks like it's filled with Native yeah. American art.
Yeah.
Like that's more the, and then also, or like what you were saying, you could use your ears to hear the person say, this was buried on an Indian.
Yeah.
Like there's point.
Yeah. Because if Stanley Kubrick, put those Calumet things there on purpose, he then also put those Nilla wafer things there on purpose. So
yeah,
you could probably make an argument that they are there to obfuscate those or camouflage them or make it seem silly and inane so that only the true visionaries can see it.
Yes.
But not me. I want the Nilla wafer conspiracy.
Well, you know? the why do you choose Calumet? And if that's chosen, then so is Nilla wafers. The thing that my version of that when I was watching it was, he was saying that the floor in room 237 was
yeah.
little dicks.
Yeah, the sexuality.
And then the outside of it is hexagons, like a hive, which is like
yeah.
the way we try to structure and have communities or whatever, versus procreating in the other room. And that's such a far leap, obviously. It's funny because it's like just you could look at it as like, well, Stanley Kubrick had to make a choice between what the out floor looked like, the rug, the carpeting in each room. And for whatever reason, it felt right to have the ones that look like dicks in the bedroom. And for whatever reason, the hexagons in the hallway felt right. And that might not have anything to do with sex or how people build communities. But it's interesting just as a thing to think about. Like, 100%. Oh, why do they look like dicks in the bedroom and then are like so regimented and geometric?
It's the same thing with the fact that there's a window in Ullman's office and there's some inconsistencies to how the hotel is laid out. None of these people ever stop to think of the simplest solution, and that is a movie's ultimate goal is to tell a story on a screen, not to be like architecturally accurate to real life. So those things are, I doubt anyone's ever watched Shining for the first time and noticed that those things are off. It's only on multiple viewings. So the filmmaker then knows that that's not a concern and knows it's better just laid out the way it needs to be laid out. So that's how movie making is done. Mm-hmm. It's not about continuity. And Stanley, I think himself, now I'm on a first name basis, by the way. But the best thing in this movie to me was the key fob for room 237 and the guy going, look, it's room and N-O, which is an acronym for number, which is not its abbreviation. And the only words you can make out of that are room and moon. And I'm just sitting there going, no, you can get moron out of that too. And how did he not see that? And was that not a sign to him? Funny. But he would have taken that and gone, the morons do not see.
Yes, yes.
That the moon thing happens.
The morons are the people who are tricked by the moon landing. Maddie, I gotta pee. So I'm gonna go pee right now in my pants.
We'll be right back.
Okay. With Crawley and Rust.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
After years of fine print contracts and getting ripped off by overpriced wireless providers, if we've learned anything, Paul, is that there's always a catch. So when I heard that for a limited time, all Mint Mobile wireless plans are $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan, I thought, what's the catch?
Yeah, but after talking to them, it all made sense, right? Because there isn't one!
You got me!
Mint Mobile's secret sauce is that they sell wireless service online. Correct me if I'm wrong, Matt.
You are right, my friend.
And they cut out the cost of retail stores and pass those sweet savings directly to you and to all their users.
I'm living in a cell phone dead zone, but not anymore thanks to Mint Mobile. You can say bye-bye to your overpriced wireless plans, jaw-dropping monthly bills, and unexpected overages.
Because Mint Mobile is here to rescue you with a premium wireless plan starting at $15 a month.
All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network.
Uh-huh. And you can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number. Isn't that convenient? Along with all your existing contacts.
Ditch those overpriced wirelesses with Mint Mobile's limited-time deal and get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month.
Yeah, so to get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/rust. Hey, that's my last name, R-U-S-T.
That's mintmobile.com/rust. Hey, that's your last name, R-U-S-T.
So cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/rust. Hey, that's me.
New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. I just want to say, as we close this ad out, there were no edits. We nailed this.
We nailed it.
It's like we were on a Mint Mobile phone call.
Beautiful.
With Goalie and Rust.
Matt, hello. We're
Hi.
Back.
We're back.
I was just looking over at our live screen here, and public speaking, the person known as public speaking. Sanest person in the dock, question mark?
I was going to ask that same question in terms of which conspiracy theory seems, if you had to pick one that you thought like could be the most true, I guess it would be the Native American one for me.
Yeah.
Because the person doing the layouts of the set doesn't really have a conspiracy theory. Really?
No, I mean, that person is the most interesting.
I agree.
I'm just grateful, like, he pointed out, like, oh, that weird edit that happens when they're walking in the hedge and, like, when they're walking by the hedge and then it cuts and they're walking the other way perpendicular, but the conversation's continuing. Like, or just, like, the observation of, like, when the hotel dissolves, the ladder is in the archway, and it looks like the guy, the janitor, sweeping. It looks like he's sweeping the trees. Just like,
yeah.
He also pointed out that thing about the rug. It seemed like he was also just admiring like choreography stuff. He would be like, yeah. Oh, the guy who comes in at the rug at the very beginning of the scene, he's leaving at the steps at the very end when they like Bill, Jack, and Mr. Ullman like all walk off together. That guy who you saw at the very beginning is just leaving. Like, whether that, I don't even think that person's saying that has meaning or purpose or whatever. Yeah, just it's just like cool admiration.
Yeah. Do you think there's that one moment where the guy goes, they want to make Bill to be sinister and kind of like the real mastermind behind this. And he goes, and just watch in the end when he's asked to take his luggage, the sigh he makes. And they go, could you get Mr. Torrance's luggage? And he goes, all right.
Yeah, fine.
Or, fine, yeah.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny. I thought the documentary does a cool thing where within 5 minutes of that, they have Bill saying fine to prove two people's separate versions of what Bill is. Like, somebody's like, Bill's obviously like this. Notice how he goes, like, after he's asked to do this, and he goes, fine. Then, like, 5 minutes later, somebody's like, and Bill is obviously this way in this scene. It says, fine. You're like, well, it's the same thing, these two.
Yeah.
And the only thing that I noticed, that was like a cool thing where it's like somebody repeats something and you're like, oh, they're seeing the same thing but coming to different conclusions, is the end when the only time somebody repeats somebody else's observation is at the very, very end. And it's the guy who we're saying is the map guy. And then there's the genocide guy that it's about Native Americans. He repeats that guy's thing about, oh, but if you know history and you can retrace your steps like Danny does in the maze, and that kind of like concludes the documentary, and he's repeating something that the guy said earlier. So it's like, maybe in some way that's the one thing people could, yeah. I mean, my theory, I guess, is like that it's about history in some way, whether it's about genocide or Native Americans, just that it's about people at this time when this movie's being made encountering I don't know, even when we read the book, it just seemed like all the choices were, let's make it as American as possible. Remember, yes. That keeps popping up. It's like Danny's haircut, Danny's clothes, what she would wear, what he would wear, what the hotel would look like, American as possible. And it does seem it's just like somebody who grew up in America, lived there, lives in England now, is looking over being like, weird shit is happening in America. I'm going to just kind of do a kooky thing about a very American family.
Yeah. Well, when you take the book is mainly about, the novel is mainly about the family and the like, the relationship with the father's work and mental state with the family. The whole thing is, I think, a metaphor. We've talked about this, for like a father not knowing really how to
be a father and how to separate what his life was before with what it is now. And I think that's there in the movie, and even more so in the American nuclear family, like you're saying.
And but the idea of the caretaker thing, too.
Like, yeah.
What's a caretaker? Are you are you a caretaker to your family, but are you a caretaker to your country? Or,
Your but that's all there, but it's not on its sleeve.
Yes.
So that's what I get so baffled by these conspiracy theorists of, like, there's real stuff there to mine the meaning out of. You're kind of having fun in your own way, but you're kind of missing out on what I love about this movie, which is what's supernatural and what's a man unfolding on himself and what's a man who is like, he's not well. So how much of this is coming from normal day-to-day frustrations exacerbated by an isolated place and frustration with work and family? Then add on top of that the supernatural, whether it's like Native Americans. Mm-hmm. Well, someone even calls the woman in the bathtub witches. They call them witches. Yeah. Where it's like, well, no, that, especially if you really research it, it was like a gangster's mistress or something or a tycoon's mistress or something.
Yeah.
But witches, just because she looked like a hag?
Yeah. Yeah. The what's funny, the book, the making of book sort of blows that out about whatever the intentionality of stuff was, because when you read it and you realize so much stuff was being reshot and redone and going back to a scene later to reshoot it, so that explains like continuity errors. And basic analysis on continuity errors feels like the junk drawer version of analysis, because it's like they're errors. And trying to say that they have meaning is really dumb.
Especially if they're not errors, then they're like, what's the word? Like, they're willful ignorances, where they're secondary to what the filmmaker wants. They might be very aware of those errors, but don't care enough about them to get the point across.
Yes. Yeah. And and also when you read the making of book and see how much they were just re-editing it to the 11th and a half hour to get the movie ready, it really kind of blows out the idea of like thoughtful intentionality, like, because you'd just be like, there'd probably no time to go like, well, I want to change the typewriter here to represent Nazi Germany, like, it's impossible. And that seems to be like the what people misunderstand about when they do analysis about like what a movie's intending, is just like, seemingly, I mean, we've been on sets. It's just like a lot of choices are made because something fucked up.
Yeah.
And they're trying to come up with a solution, or you're running out of time and you have to do something else.
Right.
So the idea that, like, then you could make a decision like, oh, that really is then the psyche laid bare, because it was basically in a moment where you had to come up with a solution, your id or whatever, your super ego, like, everything worked together to, like, make it happen. So it says something about you. But the idea that it would come from a thoughtful, like, well, I'm trying to represent genocide here, so where would I put the camera, is pretty stupid.
I know. I don't think if your main goal is to get a point across about a hidden confession that you faked the moon landing, I don't think that's going to make you not know what the ending of your movie is until the last minute.
Yes. You know? Right. You'd be like, no, this. I know what this is going to be because it's about the moon landing.
Yeah, I need to put a button on that.
Yeah. And then, like, to your point, too, about, like, oh, there's a lot of stuff in the movie that's just not being discussed. It gets extrapolated in kind of crazy ways. I felt like the documentary, Room 237, and I do like documentaries that are like verite, where the person's voice doesn't come on and say what it is. You just kind of like whatever the suggestion is you get. And like at the end, when nobody in any of these disembodied voices have really shared anything that personal. And if they do, it's the mundane level of personal that you would get in a job interview with Ullman, like the same banal kind of stuff you would just share. I did this, I was here, I was working here. But it's not until the very, very end where the guy goes like, I mean, I gotta be honest, I could be Jack here, my son. I gotta move to a different place maybe. And I'm thinking, I don't know, is that to isolate? Is that the right way to go? And like, I felt like that was somewhat the documentary kind of being like, all of this always boils down to like whatever shit's knocking around in your head and in your life. That's the thing that
I got worried about that guy. I'm going like, this is where you're starting from and you're going to head out into isolation with your family. I started to feel like he was willing it to happen. Like there was a kind of like Heath Ledger's Joker aspirational quality to Jack Torrance for him.
Do that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hope he's okay. I guess it's over a decade later, so he's.
I wonder
it's like you said, everybody's in queue.
I think so. I guarantee some of them are. I wonder what they thought of this movie. It was interesting on both sides. Well, at least on the Kubrick side, they seemed to not like it and asked him to put that disclaimer up front. Mm-hmm. Not seeming to. I was surprised because someone who would appreciate the works of Stanley Kubrick, you think would be able to separate the nuance of what this film is doing as opposed to what its subjects are saying.
Yeah. And if the movie had been like, we're only going to take the not crazy stuff, it'd be the fucking dorkiest ass documentary in the world. If somebody was like, I'm using my 90 minutes of documentary time to try to get these salient points across about the analysis of the show.
Yeah.
Like, it's so much groovier and cooler than that because it's like, no, this is going to be about interpretation and like where people's brains. So,
The flip side of that, though, they don't go so far to make fun
mockery,
of the people.
Yes, which is
which
good
had been
too,
so easy to do too. Easy. I probably wouldn't have been able to resist.
It would have been the thing that a documentary 10 years before that probably would have done. It would have been like, look at these Guffman, at these
or
Christopher
Michael Moore.
Living. Yes,
you know.
But when you watch it, the people they mention, like that mastermind, MSTRMND.
Yeah.
I remember reading that website long before documentary came out.
Oh, wow.
And being like, oh, they couldn't get Mastermind. Interesting. And then the person they're talking, this guy did an essay about, this speaks to your question of like, how did they feel when it came out, is one guy did a video. He's like the master Shining analysis guy.
Is he the one that has the books and was going to release the film himself that he was holding back?
No, who's that?
There's one guy saying he has a film coming out.
Oh, this is the Eyes Wide Shut guy I was telling you about, right?
No, not that guy. The guy in this.
Oh.
And he, when you search his name, he has all these prophecy books and stuff that are, you know, seem self-published. And
I see. Well, I don't know if
by their graphic design.
The guy is Rob Ager, A-G-E-R.
That might be him.
And you can read his stuff. I mean, like, I didn't know about the Playgirl magazine in room 230, like, until I saw the documentary.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, that's such a cool little tidbit.
Well, that is that the one thing I was like, what is the point of that? That had to be a choice, unless it's...
And the guy briefly says, oh, there's an article in there about incest, and so that's a form of family abuse. Maybe it's in there, you know, that's a stretch, but... This guy, Rob Ager, who I really do like his videos. They're like well edited. He makes occasionally a political point that I just disagree with or something, but I get by it. And I just appreciate his voice. If it had been in this documentary, it would have been really great. He has like a, I think he's Irish. So he has this just like gentle voice to like ASMR. Like, and some stuff, you know, I don't agree with, but I've watched probably most of his videos. I signed up for his website so I could pay him to download the videos that aren't possible on YouTube. So I really like the guy.
Oh, yeah. I'd like to get into
And he those. Says stuff that, like I said, I don't agree with, but there's some stuff that I'm just like, oh, wow. I'm really going to think about Alien in a different way now because of Rob Ager. So he gives a reason for why he didn't do it. It seemed like he could probably sense, I'm not going to get my points of view across in a way that I could probably just do on my own.
This
my
he
videos.
Could sense this wouldn't be about his analysis. It would be about him.
Yeah. That it might not just be about like, let's really look at what this guy is saying about, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was what his own personal reasons were, but the fact that Mastermind also, the guy who runs that website didn't, do it. I don't know. I wonder if people sensed, or they even though the documentary doesn't mock them, like you said, maybe they've seen enough documentaries about kooks and they're like, I don't want to get written off just as a kook.
I used to have that issue on I Was There Too, where there were people that wouldn't want to come on because that felt like, oh, you see me as a bit player. And I don't think that's what I either am or don't want to be seen as opposed to not the way I saw it. I saw it as like, let's celebrate a smaller role, significant smaller role.
Yeah, there's
but
no
you couldn't
players.
Get that across to people in an email. So some people would just go for it and some people wouldn't.
Yeah, but that's like what they bring to their... I mean, it makes me think of the thing in the room 237 where they like... I don't know if the words are exactly right, but I do see the idea of taking confusing history like a genocide, figuring out an image that gives you a sense of that, and then because that is most like what a dream does. You just have a symbol.
Yeah.
And the point isn't made after this. But it does seem to say, well, if the conclusion is like The Shining has a bunch of dreams that are kind of like Freudian or dreamlike, where like, well, that's why everybody's having all these different interpretations. Because it'd be like if everybody had a mass dream and woke up the next day and tried to interpret what it meant, everybody would bring their own shit to it.
Yeah.
And you can't just go like it's easy as like one interpretation because... I mean, Eyes Wide Shut feels dreamlike too. Like I couldn't just, if I said like the for guy sure. following him is actually his father, you know, be like, oh, Rusty has issues with his daddy. Like, why is he saying that? It's like a Rorschach test or whatever. You know.
The thing about all these theories on top of what I think is a very clear theory, and that is this about a family.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I feel like Stanley Kubrick is too, find a filmmaker to pile that many metaphoric or themes on top of each other that maybe some of them are adjacent to each other or like kind of indirectly causing the other, like the Native American thing. But I feel like it would be too confusing, too muddled a set of theses to put on a film for such a quality filmmaker. I think it's too unfocused.
Yes.
And especially when you put all these together, I know that they're all different theories from different people, but I just feel like that's what I can't get past is that these people, no one's acknowledging what this movie is really about on it, just below the surface, if not on the surface. They're digging so deep to mine gems that aren't there that actually, if you were really to say, okay, it is about the Nazis and World War II specifically, then what do you do with all the rest of the stuff that's plainly there? That's just too dirty and too muddled for Kubrick,
oh, right.
Especially.
That person's not getting a clean shot with their idea of like, this is the movie that symbolizes if they had all this extra stuff in there, like they.
Yeah. Or it belittles all this stuff that's there already. That's so rich. It's not like it's just, hey, this is about a family just straight on the surface with no subtext. There's definitely something there about American families on the surface as subtext, as urtext.
Yes,
and going below and below.
Yeah.
I do want to get back to that Playgirl because that is the one thing that I feel like.
Oh,
why?
That was the thing that I was going to say. Rob Ager, like a theory that's just exploded online now that he extrapolated and is one that I'm like, I don't agree with this, is that Playgirl about the incest is suggesting that like Danny was abused physically, sexually by Jack. And I imagine it has just a bit of Q child sex abuse conspiracy theories notion to it, that's why people end up sharing that video and that becomes a more interesting theory. And, you know, Danny is on a bear when the doctor visits him, he's laying on the bear. So that's why the bear man is filleting. He's like,
but that's a dog later.
I know. None of it is like
And that also implies that anybody who doesn't have a video telling them about this could zoom in on that incest article, unless you're just implying that people that are interested in naked men are also pedophiles.
It can't be that. And then and also this just the guy like who plays Bill Watson said Jack Nicholson brought it in as a joke.
That's okay. So that's,
yeah, he says it. He was like, "Oh yeah, Jack Nicholson had it. He thought it'd be funny if it's just." So you're like, "Okay." Oh, so they're assuming that's you can't freeze frame this and get perfect 4K
right
clarity.
That's absolutely it. And yeah. even if Kubrick knew, you could see him kind of going, "All right,
yeah,"
you know, because it's not that clear. Because there'd be no. They're so accurate to every nuance and detail of an American hotel. There'd be no way a playgirl would be sitting in the lobby.
Yes. And you could look at it that if you just look at it as like a funny thing, then it is really funny that this guy works so hard during the job interview to mind his P's and Q's to get the job. And then when he gets the job on his first day, the boss rolls up and he's reading a playgirl. He's like, yeah, what? Okay. Yeah, let's go.
Tenure, baby.
Exactly. Yeah. The, I was thinking last night about the thing that I think I admire about Stanley Kubrick movies are that the stories are so simple.
Yeah.
And you could basically say them in a sentence. And so the fact that like they're so simple enough that people can inject a bunch of things, but
yeah, that's the danger of that kind of thing is you have a brilliant person who makes something simple and that's the goal. Yeah. And then all these little bottom feeding scavengers come along and post their little barnacles all over it. And
I mean, this isn't exactly the idea of a simple story told simply, and that can be its own. Then you can go deeper because you're not worried about the microfilm fell in the hands, but they double tricked them, and now it's over in the other like whatever plot. I can't follow those, so yeah. That's probably why I dislike it. But like. Watching cartoon animated features with my daughter, like the most pleasurable. I mean, Pixar is on its own level, I suppose, and that is true. But the movies that I like most respond to are the ones that the only kids movies that are really being made. I don't know if you notice this. The first half hour is just like. Fucking rule time.
Oh yeah.
It's all about world building and the rules of what the plot's going to be and what and what's not possible.
And Kanto has like 20 minutes of this is who this person is, this is their power, this it's all in a song. Like it's all exposition.
It's all exposition, plot, story, and it's like
Moana, Frozen, they all start with that.
The thing I love, you know, and I even like loved the movie Soul, and it really moved me. But like that first 40 minutes is like this, you can do this, but you can't do that. And I'm like, if I was a kid, I'd be like, guys, I get enough rules up my ass all day. Yeah. Like, let me. Just my point is the movies that I really, really enjoy are the Hotel Transylvania movies because the stories are so clear and clean. The first one is like.
There are more than one movie of.
Yeah.
Really?
First one, it's like. I don't know if this guy's right for my daughter. The second one is, I don't know if they're raising their kid right. And the third one is the Count Dracula being like, I want to find somebody, a new wife. I don't know if I'm ready to start that chapter.
Yeah.
And because those stories are so clear, like you get like 90 minutes of just like really funny cartoon gags. Yeah. Which is like, oh. So anyway, I way prefer this like, a Shining thing, just being like, oh, this one sentence description is like a guy has to take care of a hotel. He goes crazy and tries to kill his family.
Yeah.
Like, as opposed to, there was a zoning committee that wanted to tear down the hotel and one man, what levers of power he had to pull in order to save the hotel or something like that.
Well, it's funny you say that because Stanley Kubrick, purposefully omitted the scrapbook from this movie, which even though it doesn't come at the beginning, would have given you a lot of logic behind some of the stuff you see. You would know more about some of the visions you're seeing, the woman in room 237, if they did a cursory little flip through of that scrapbook, you know?
Yeah. What, I mean,
that, where's your conspiracy theory on that?
Well, it's funny. You had to be so, meticulous. If the idea is that everything is so meticulously chosen to get a point across, like to have it get across, then like, well, that scrapbook scene then most certainly should have been included there.
And the fact that Kubrick burns all his unused footage, I can't believe that's low hanging fruit for a conspiracy theorist to go, you know. And ultimately, Kubrick confessed it literally. But that footage has been burned.
Yes, it was there.
Kubrick is a master of depth of focus, and there's a message in the background because every number is a message. That's the other thing.
Yeah, that everybody has to be Decker and be like enhance square 23A, and then boop, 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 so you can look up closely enough to be like, yes, that is a picture of a mask. Therefore, it's eyes wide shut.
Oh, yeah. And everything's a multiple of seven, except all the numbers in the movie that aren't.
Oh, near the end, that one guy who's like so funny, he goes like, and then of course, 237 times two, that equals 42, 1942. And then he goes, I realize I could be grasping at straws here. I thought that was a very charming thing for him.
Oh, but I wish his intentions were better, because that read to me like, lest you think I'm crazy.
Yes.
I mean, I still want you to believe this.
There's parts of this movie that feel like a guy walking up to you in a parking lot at a grocery store and handing you a pamphlet and be like, read this.
If someone handed me a printed pamphlet of their crackpot shining ideas, I would love it.
Well, what do they call it? Literacy, media literacy or something like that.
Yeah.
Like, it was frustrating me with like the Kubrick estate and Leon Vitali being like, as opposed to just seeing this as like either people appreciating Stanley Kubrick's movie or a look into how people, that he would take it as a defense. He was like, he thinks, so this movie is saying that Stanley Kubrick would lie to his own wife.
Yeah.
That just felt like somebody's response who would, that was coming at something else that the movie
did
was
they
never
even
offering.
Watch it? Because as much as I can't stand crackpot conspiracy theorists, also the people on the Kubrick side, you have to acknowledge that there's such ambiguity in his movies that they're ripe for interpretation. So I think that's unavoidable with every one of his films, obviously, because look how many people sit there and try to do this with Kubrick. That's part of the fun. It's just having a little self-restraint,
right?
I think would serve you well.
Yes. What do you think? Do you see what now? Are we four episodes in, five episodes in, Mining the Shining?
Yeah. Well, Shining by ourselves, Andy, Lee Unkrich, Tosh and Deep Dive. Yeah, this is the fifth episode out of six.
So we've kind of danced around it a bit in this episode, but like if you had to put in a sentence like what The Shining means, you think it's just like, you keep it as like it's about a nuclear family coming apart. Like,
good question. I think,
because I don't have like an analysis theory. Like if somebody asked
me,
like,
I don't know if I do,
I would
either.
Be like, well, I have a thought it gives me or something. Like it has me have thoughts, but
like
I don't
know. The plot is very clear. A family moves to a hotel and a man becomes possessed, and his, child with superpowers perceives it, and the wife saves her son, and he is damned.
I think if I...
That's not...
If I was 22 years old and I went and saw it, was walking out of the theater and had to come up with what did that mean? I probably would think, oh, it is... You know, in the scene when he's saying, do you have any idea the responsibilities that I take when I made an oath here? I would be like, oh, this is what it feels to be a family right now. Things are kind of like in America or in life. Things are falling apart.
Too.
And a husband or a father right now in this situation is kind of going crazy about what he thinks he traditions that need to be honored things that are values that we have to hold on to, while his wife and child, youth and women, are kind of going like, I think you're off about this, dude. Like, that's what would be in my brain. Kind of like, that's
me too.
What it felt like.
I think it's an expressionistic representation of the repressed American man / father.
Yeah.
And I think you could make a case that that's what the novel's saying.
Mm-hmm.
King has said as much. Whether Kubrick is still using that, and I think he probably is, although this documentary will tell you he's changing King's vision purely by evidenced by a red Volkswagen. Unbelievable.
I love that that means that guy thinks that FU is going to come across to the audience because they know the color of the Volkswagen
or Stephen King
the book.
Even.
Or even
that's
Stephen
even,
King,
yeah.
Ganked out of his mind on coke, is going to like sit there and be like, oh, that was an F.
I give you even odds. He even remembers the color of the original.
Yes. Yeah. That particular level, too, of like, I love that type of dumb conspiracy theory. It's like, we'll use the book as the text for what it should be, and anything that's different from the book has to be added in there because of the reason. It's such a funny way. I mean, it is like, I'm not making a big observation here. It's pretty obvious, but it is like conspiracy theory, but also just like whatever evidence you get, and then the crazy extrapolations people make of it, being like, oh, there could have been. I'm sure there was a dude, Christ, who lived and probably spoke of, had a philosophy about goodness and love in the earth and how if you put that out, it comes back to you. But then whatever that was gets like you're saying the barnacle has come on and they attach themselves to that. And then their extrapolations become not just like, huh, I don't know if that's the case, but like, counter to whatever the thing was. You're just like, oh boy, we've really gotten far afield with people's, the power of their own.
Yeah.
I mean, we talked about the Manson thing being so funny that because the White Album was the first popular music that wasn't like, hey, baby, baby, I want to kiss my baby.
Yeah.
You could, the only way you could understand it is like, it must be, I have to read between the lines to make this the devil.
Yeah, it has to be.
Like, could it just be, oh, it's poetry and the words sound nice when you say that?
If there's a spectrum of popular filmmakers and you have, you know, all the mainstream films that are just what you see is what you get, or if there's a theme, it's clear, but there's still a really clear plot and story. Mm-hmm. And then maybe on the farther end, you have a David Lynch who's pure, often pure expressionism to the point where, when I first saw Eraserhead, I thought, this is a pile of shit. It's just weird for weird's sake. But then it took me understanding what expressionism was, that it's the outward expression of inward fears and anxieties. So it's not supposed to be literal. It's supposed to make you feel a certain way, not tell you a story necessarily. And I didn't know that.
And it's funny, you can go on this Reddit thread for Bo is Afraid.
Yeah.
And people have all their theory. I follow it because it's fun to read people's theories. But the fact that they're not grasping what you're saying about Eraserhead, it's like, it's just the expression of the person feeling in that moment, how they're feeling it. It could be as easy as that, guys.
It unlocked things like that for me, not in a way that I could go, oh, I now understand expressionistic cinema, but now I felt like, oh, they let me in. I just need to know this one definition and I can appreciate this, because I was frustrated before because there was no clear story. But when he goes over to pick up his date and there's a woman in the radiator going and that uncle going, you're looking at my knees, I was just like, this is so silly and so stupid. But no, it was the anxiety he was having about going on a date shown carnivalistic way. And then I think you've got Kubrick in the middle, that is such a wonderful medley or like melding of those two
things.
And
we learned that they watch Eraserhead when they're
and that it works as a straightforward mainstream film, and it works as an expressionism film, where Lynch doesn't really work as a mainstream film as much as you may love it, and a mainstream film doesn't really have much expressionism.
My parents could more likely hook into Full Metal Jacket than Blue Velvet, and they came out with the same year.
I just love that mix because you're satisfied on both levels, and it's why it invites this kind of, you know, examination of it. But unlike Lynch, I mean this in a complimentary way. I don't think there's the depth of theme that these people want it to have. There's a good, concrete, simple theme, but I don't think it's a hidden treasure hunt. You know what I mean?
I mean, it's just, because with David Lynch, that was somebody who in college, I had that. It's funny, when I saw Eraserhead in high school, that was the one David Lynch thing that I like, because I think it was so weird that but the other stuff I would have the reaction of like, it's weird for weird's sake and it's annoying to me.
And sometimes you still get that feeling like, does David Lynch really even know what feeling he wants to do, or is he just like, this will be funny today?
So I had that reaction, and this isn't the case. He might be the only case of this with like art or something, music or whatever, but it really took before and after, I tried marijuana. It's funny that David Lynch was like one of the few people who was like, after I smoked, I was like, okay, David Lynch makes a little more sense to me. Like, it doesn't, dude. I don't have to get hung up on the what's and whys. I just can enjoy the experience. That's what, and I can feel it in my heart and head at the same time. It's cool, you know.
Same but, here, yeah.
Yeah, but and the
what made me appreciate surrealism and absurdism, that sometimes it's just the ride you get to go on, not the point A to the point B.
Yeah.
It's that, you know, the journey, not the destination. And that there's real merit to that. If it's a fun ride,
yes.
There are certain versions of it that I don't find
the ride is fun.
Like excruciating at times, you know?
Yeah.
But a good, fun, absurdist ride. Oh, yeah. And I love absurdist comedy is probably my favorite if it's well done too.
Yeah. So. I've been thinking lately what seems to be the stuff I like most, like Beau's Afraid probably was my favorite thing I've seen this year. The stuff that can like most represent how things feel chaotic right now is the stuff that I'm liking most.
I have a fraught relationship with that because it hits home in a good way, but at the same time, it hits home. And I'm like, I don't know if I'm ready to.
When it's played as comedy, I like it because it helps me then. Like today, before I came over here, I just had a really complicated thing with a parking thing. And it was like, I got to an elevator and a sign on the elevator said, button doesn't work, light doesn't work, but button does, or something like that. And I was in this, like, whatever somebody would say as a Kafka, like, just a nightmare of bureaucracy and stuff. Beau is Afraid, honestly, because it's a dark comedy. When I'm in those moments, I can think to myself, Jesus, this is a real Beau is Afraid moment. And laughed at, I take comfort in like, oh, a movie is acknowledging like, it is really fucking weird how after I get out of that, then I have to wait to get through a door because the person going through the door is just like looking at their phone up close. You're like, this is so fucking
and your
weird.
Precious moments of your precious life are eaten up by that kind of thing. Multiple times recently, I've had to deal with a major telecommunications company that because I had a credit card compromised and I need to change my card information, but I can't log in because their system's down, but they're still sending me emails going, you have to pay this or you're going to lose your service. And that feedback loop of like absurdist, why is my precious flesh of this time with my daughter and my wife and my friends, I have to allocate time to
this. And if you look at what's always, what really any comedy is a level of irony, the thing I expected and the thing I got. The fact that like we do all of that for convenience sake.
Yeah.
So when that's like when it becomes ridiculous, it's like I'm on this phone trying to talk to an air travel for 45 minutes because it's convenient.
Right.
Like, it's so, the thing you're saying about the story, Stanley Kubrick's, that they're entertaining and you can enjoy them on that level and then have the meanings and stuff later. The book did kind of help. Either by the way he spoke about it or how people spoke about The Shining, it did sort of reconfirm and the way his wife talked about how he saw people and saw things, it did reconfirm a little bit of whatever my like macro look at his movies, which is like, I think I said on the before with the pod, where it's like the movies are usually like, we realize some human impulse could get hairy. So we're going to come up with a system to make sure that doesn't happen. But then the plot complication is, no, the system now is actually getting in the way of solving the problem. And the reason that it'll never work is because of the impulse that we were trying to control at the beginning is always going to rear its head. So whatever that, like, the fight between what your mind knows is right and what your body wants to do, like, that to me is like, oh, that's Strangelove, that's 2001, that's Eyes Wide Shut. It's all about, like, people are inclined to do one thing that's kind of, like, evil.
Yeah. Full Metal Jacket too.
I'm
here to kill, but my mind is saying no, but we march on.
Clockwork Orange is like, there's people who do bad things. Well, maybe we can come up with criminal justice that will take care of this thing. No, because then people bring their own politics to it and our human impulses to like want to get an award for what we've done to help criminals. The neck gets in the way. It's just like there's... And then, yeah, with Eyes Wide Shut, it is funny that it's like domesticity will solve all of the problems that two people who are intimate with each other would solve. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. But the thing that's said in Room 237, and the thing that I do think is like most, The Shining does seem just like a really depressed person's movie in a way. It doesn't have a lot of hope. But Eyes Wide Shut has way more hope to me about how people can work things out, or that there's a promise that you can have clarity at some points to figure things out. Like, The Shining and Full Metal Jacket seem pretty bleak.
Yeah, Eyes Wide Shut, they end the movie pretty cynical, but they at least seem relieved to be honest about some things. Like,
and
the
there's
burden
a promise that
of,
they're going to have sex, which is like, oh, well, if they're doing that, then they might have a second kid and they'll procreate and things will, you know, like life continues.
And Dr. Strangelove is the most bleak ending.
Man, that's probably of all the endings I ever saw in all my life. That was the one that was most, is probably arrested me.
Really?
Just like, because the whole time you're watching the movie, you think it's not going to happen. Well, boy. I mean, what for you do you think was the ending that most blew you away of like...
It was Halloween.
Yeah.
For sure. And just because of my age and time.
But, and then not
but
knowing
maybe
it.
Like overall... Oh, boy.
It's funny though, Strangelove and Halloween, they're both similar endings, which is like the propulsion of all those... Both of those movies is, well, of course they're going to figure out a way that the bomb doesn't drop.
Yeah.
Or of course they're going to figure out a way to make sure that this monster is vanquished. And so what's the gut punch about those endings is like, it's not. The bomb does drop and the guy does get away. It's like the thing that you were like taking security in. It's like, oh. I remember once I was watching a dumb light comedy once, a movie, and I just was getting so frustrated by the misunderstandings and I wanted the two people to fall. And I was talking to my friend Ellen about it. And she was like, don't worry, you know they're going to figure it out.
Yeah.
Like, there are times in movies where I have to go like, Paul, you know they're going to figure it out.
Yeah.
So it sucks with it, or it's scary when they don't.
Yeah.
Well, any thoughts else on before
no,
we...
No, I mean, I think that's a good good place to leave it.
And then any thoughts about how next week is we're closing with Dr. Sleep?
That's right, the director's cut.
We're closing the mine shaft for mining
we're
the
we're sealing
shiny.
It up.
Yeah.
There might be some time we go back and mine a little more. Who knows? But
yeah, I think, you know, going back into the Red Book and revisiting some stuff that maybe we didn't get to talk to, that could be a fun bonus down the line.
Yeah,
or yeah,
that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we could... read some Xenos.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm also, I think, interested in watching Dr. Sleep because now it'll be cool just to see that a revisit to The Shining after watching The Shining. Thinking about
I know. Something. And how I am curious just from a filmmaking perspective how they, I think, if I remember correctly, fairly synthesized the novel and the movie into one kind of resolution with this. Like it uses both. It's a sequel to the novel, but it can't deny that the movie's more sort of relevant. So
it is a risk though to say Dr. Sleep for film critics. Oh yeah, this movie was a doctor for sleep. You know, it's like a real big risk.
We're giving our films the rating of either Dr. Sleep or Dr. Feelgood. What would you find Dr. Sleep?
Did Peter want a Watto to say a shout out? Hey, you got this one, you lucky.
D.D. Peter's got her name said by Watto. Baby Xenomorph, baby Xenomorph.
Just a nothing fancy. Just
Mike Lindell.
Michael
Lindell.
Wow, thank you, Michael.
Michael Lindell, maybe also. Is that that?
Oh Mitch? Yeah, new no-no for Mitch Garin.
Mitch Garin. Oh, Mitch Garin. I'm Garen to Darren to Baron the Sharon. Oh, no, no, no. Your name rhymes with things. Mitch Garen.
John Keithley, this is HR Giger. Her Giger is a HR is an abbreviation like MR for Mr. I'm Hister Giger.
Hister O'Hare Giger. Yeah, yeah, that's good.
Shout out anyway.
Paul as Gus from the pilot episode of Love Telling Off the Curmudgeon on the balcony.
I'll say your name at the end of the quote that you thankfully wrote for me, and I'm saying this out loud so people don't think I'm a douchebag or just like get rote memorize lines. Hey, why don't you just let us enjoy this one special moment in our lives before we fucking slip in a shower and turn to mush? Go fuck yourself, Ross LaFleur. That's not true. You're the opposite of who I'd say go fuck yourself, but it worked.
Max and Alicia Gutman, it's me again, Hister Giger, but I'm antihistamine Hister Giger, meaning no inflammation and no allergies.
Oh my God, it'd be hard for me if I was a baby Zeno deciding if I wanted to do Giger or Kirshner.
I think for you, I would choose the esteemed member of Pinhead's court. Could you give me a shout out as that?
Matthew Gourley is the most notorious member of Pinhead's court.
Oh, that's good.
We're coming up on a year anniversary of me, Mike Mitchell telling me about that video.
Funny.
How Butterball is the most nefarious member of Pinball's court. Pinhead's court. Pinball's court. Oh, sign me up.
Here's one, just a straight up.
Yeah. Mark Slade.
Okay.
Cool name.
Oh, hello. Just here to talk about Ruben Cruz, not to be associated with Tom Cruise, because I would never defend someone right. like that in a court of law. I would sooner defend, is his name Sean Harris, who plays the creepy villain in those movies for a long time?
Ooh, which one did what?
He's the one that talks.
I'm doing Peter Lorre. He's just like in part five and six, he's the villain that has like a two movie or three movie arc.
Hello, Jason Anthony Harris. This is Har Giger saying, shout it out.
Oh, wow. Here's a sonnet. We'll read that off air. That's very nice.
I like that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew Fantasia.
And finally for today, we'll read more because we've got them later on.
It's me. I'm back. I'd like to shout out Joseph Hillard.
That's a good name for something. Boy.
Very good. Joseph Hillard. Look, if you want to hire my services, all you got to do is go out and kill a bunch of campers on any given lake on any given summer's eve. Disposable douche.
Yeah, summer's eve.
Bye now.
Bye. I guess we'll see you guys next week for Dr. Sleep. And we'll also be choosing our selections for the yuppies.
That's right. We got a nightmares little homework to do.
Yeah.
Do you want to, we'll say goodbye to the podcasters and then we'll maybe answer a question or two on streaming.
Yeah, let's answer some questions on the live stream. But thanks for joining us, listeners. We'll see you next week.
Bye-bye.
For more Gourley and Rust content, head over to patreon.com/withGourleyandRust to get episodes ad-free and a whole week early. Plus, monthly mailbag episodes and feature-length watch-along film commentaries of your favorite horror classics. That's patreon.com/withGourleyandRust. Email us at withGourleyandRust@gmail.com, and your questions might be featured on a future mailbag episode. With Gourley and Rust theme song by me, Matt Gourley, and performed by Townland. You can find us on Instagram as Townland Band, as well as Paul's fantastic band at Don't Stop or We'll Die. And why not rate and review with Gourley and Rust on Apple Podcasts? It'll help us grow the show and keep us trucking through the Jasons and the Michaels, the Leatherfaces and the Chuckies, the Aliens and the Candymans.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.